We'll officially call the House Commerce Committee to order. Representative Hoppe moves House File 2553 be recommended, passed, and sent to.
As far as I know,
the General Register. Okay. Welcome to the committee, Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We are here talking about, and it did say the wealth-related claims, but it's actually weather-related. And with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Johnson, and we'll get started.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And what I'll do is just briefly, I think you have some materials in your packet. Okay, related to the bill, and so if you could pull those out.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Chairman Hoppe, I believe is the first thing we want to do is delete Section 1.
Well, yeah, we can do that right away if you want. We're going to talk a little bit about Section 1 and then remove that.
I had thought
that would be the more controversial part of the bill, but why don't we, as we do that, can we do it as one amendment to delete Section 1 and put this amendment on, or do we need to do that as two separate?
Separate would be better.
Okay. Then I will offer an amendment to delete Section 1 from the bill.
Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Section 1 is deleted. Chair Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I will also offer the A-12 amendment.
Okay, members, you have the A-12-0712 amendment. Any discussion to that to get the bill in the order the author would like?
And Mr. Chair, we can have Mr. Johnson explain why we're doing the amendment.
Mr. Johnson, why are we doing the amendment?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, the A-12 amendment represents language that, as a result of conversations with the Commerce Department and concerns with deleting the language in the statutes that we delete in Section 2, we've changed the approach, and we're going to keep a consumer disclosure regarding the homeowner's non-renewal plan, and it'll be disclosed to the consumer at the time of policy issuance and then at each renewal. So that's in lieu of the deletion of a letter that's currently sent out when an individual files a claim. And we believe that it's an inappropriate time to send a letter to a consumer that tells them they may be canceled if they file another claim right at the time they're filing a claim. So we're not changing any of the legal ground rules regarding cancellation or non-renewal. We're changing the timing of the disclosure. So that's what the A-12 amendment does. I did meet with Mr. Reich just a few minutes ago, and this gets us much closer. There might be some minor issues with this that we'll deal with them between now and when this bill is heard in the Senate Commerce Committee, but that's the reason for the A-12 amendment, Mr. Chairman.
So, Mr. Johnson, you're saying the department supports the A-12-0712 amendment at this time with further negotiations possible?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, with some possible tweaks, I believe, is the terminology we're using.
Okay, is there anyone in the audience that would wish to testify for or with concerns on the A-12-0712 amendment? It's good to see, Mr. Chairman, so many people here for my Township Mutual bill, isn't it?
Well, we knew that'd be a firestorm.
Yes. Okay, any questions for members? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have the bill in the order that the chairman would like, I believe. Okay, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman and committee members, if you have the materials in front of you, one lists the organizations.
Could you please state your name and who you represent for the record again for the tape?
Mr. Chairman, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota.
Thank you, sir.
There's one piece of paper in your packet that lists the organizations in addition to the Insurance Federation of Minnesota, the Builders Association of Minnesota, the Minnesota Independent Insurance Agents and Brokers, the Professional Insurance Agents of Minnesota, and then the Minnesota Association of Farm Mutual Insurance Companies. So this is a joint agent company initiative and piece of legislation to address, and it's our third year in a row actually in trying to respond to and deal with the issues that we are seeing in Minnesota specifically related to weather related claims. And I know we don't have the time today, Mr. Chairman, but you know, Section 1 of the bill represented an effort and an ongoing effort on our part, both companies and agents, with the Commerce Department and in conversations to address a problem that's affecting consumers' pocketbooks in this state. And the problem is that we have had an extraordinarily high amount of weather-related claims in this state, such that in years 2007 and 2008 and 2007, Minnesota had the second highest level of catastrophe losses in the nation of all 50 states, $747 million. The only state higher was California. In 2008, we had the third highest number of catastrophe losses. Again, these are weather-related claims. It was some $1.5 billion in Minnesota. And only Texas and Louisiana. And so Minnesota's become a consistent top catastrophe state, literally in the category and the class of the hurricane states. And I don't know, I don't think many people are aware of that. And so there's a lot of issues feeding that. Obviously, the weather patterns are changing and they're different. But in statistics-wise, we did on the there's a piece of paper in your packet that says weather-related claims taking a toll on homeowners insurance. And there is a link provided on that sheet, Mr. Chairman, that I would urge members when another time when they have some time to look at that link. It's a very detailed presentation put together by one of the nation's leading property casualty experts, Dr. Bob Hartwig, that he gave to a summit that we had in Minnesota back on November 1st of 2011, where we had over 26 insurance companies and representatives and independent agents from throughout the state and others, Commerce Department in attendance, presenting facts on what's going on in the changing patterns in Minnesota. But the point of it is that it's been a dramatic change. It's a consistent change. It is causing and has translated. There's another sheet in your packet that lists the average premiums in Minnesota and how we rank. And over a 10-year period from 1997 to 2009, premiums in Minnesota have increased 250%. So I think if any of you, both personally, whatever you're paying for homeowners premiums, but if you talk to any of your family, friends, or neighbors, we're talking double-digit gains every year for a decade. That does not include the last 2 years. Over that same comparable period, the average increases around the country have been 90%. So 250% in Minnesota versus the 90%. So we just comment on that because affordability does increasingly become a problem. And as we see it, there are some specific kind of causes and issues coming together that are accelerating the trends. As I indicated, Mr. Chairman, we a few years back started an effort to deal with some specific problems. House File 2553, as it's amended, continues that. We're committed to continuing to look at the issues that were found in Section 1 that we agree are not ready to proceed this year. But the discussions about deductibles, the discussions about actual cash value as opposed to replacement cost coverage, we believe are real issues that are going to need to continue, and we're committed, I know, from the company and the agent perspective to continue to have those. So what's in the bill now, Mr. Chairman and committee members? A, in Section 3 of the Section 2 of the bill I described, that's the notice that goes out once a claim is filed. Section 3 of the bill deals with a law that was originally passed in 2010. Some of you may remember it. Then there was another amendment to that law last year that Representative Sanders chief authored. And so this is the language that broadens the category of contractors who are subject to this specific statute that prohibits contractors from offering free roofs or paying the deductibles of homeowners. And so this is language that, as we have met with the agency, Department of Labor and Industry, Department of Commerce, to get language that more completely and fully covers contractors involved. Section 4 of the bill, which is probably the section that maybe is the reason the room is full here today, is that it deals with language regarding the negotiations between or the discussions between an insurance company and the contractor whom a homeowner may hire to do work. And I'll describe it, Mr. Chairman and members, this way, that it's our intention, and if we need to amend this to make this clear, we're okay with amending it to make it clear. This is language that we're trying to get at the issue of contractors acting as public adjusters. and it's an issue that's been talked about here in the legislative hearings. Contractors cannot act as public adjusters unless they have a license to be a public adjuster. And so the lines are not necessarily easy to draw clearly to know that behavior and conduct. This is language that actually the state of Missouri passed in the 2011 session to deal with this exact same issue. And so we believe, and it's our intention, that this language does, that it would not prohibit a contractor, once they have been hired, or you know, or hired by a homeowner to do the work. And so they're going to do the work, and there's a covered claim. So a covered claim for damage, that this is not intended to prohibit the contractor from having discussions about that claim with the insurer for, you know, the homeowner involved. But we believe this is a language important to put in the statutes, because frankly, one of the recent developments is that some contractors have been getting powers of attorney from their individual homeowners, and powers of attorney to work with them on the claim. And we believe that those powers of attorney muddy the water, and in fact may be a way to sidestep the public adjuster licensing requirements in Minnesota law. So that's the purpose of the language in Section 4, and then frankly the rest of the bill is technical clarifications to fit then those wording changes in Section 3 and 4. So, Mr. Chairman and committee members, that's kind of the brief background. If I could ask Mr. Chairman Ken Ohl, who is an independent agent from Spicer, Minnesota, and one of the participants that we've worked with directly on this project, if he could share some additional comments on the background on the bill, then if we could, we'd be happy to take questions at that point.
Okay, just real quickly, as far as the definition, how, Mr. Johnson, how would you say right now a contractor is acting as a public adjuster? What would they actually do physically?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think it takes the form of, and I don't have ads with me or letters or communications that contractors may put together, but it's their suggestion to the homeowner that I'll represent you in all aspects of your claim. Or I'll represent you. Their job is not to represent the homeowner vis-a-vis the claim. Their job is to do the contracting work that they've been hired for, signed a contract with. And so it's an issue that we have had numerous discussions with the Commerce Department through the years. They've issued some bulletins to try to clarify the law, to try to make specific what are the kinds of behavior that crosses over into the public adjuster category. Again, it's not a bright line to draw, because depending on the word spoken, the communication, what you're offering to do, what kind of the conduct you're trying to do, you almost have to look at a case-by-case basis. But it is definitely an issue, and it's one that we've had some considerable discussions about.
Okay, thank you. Representative Sanders?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quick housekeeping. On line 1.2, I think we need an oral amendment to fix wealth-related, turn that into weather-related to fix the tidal layer. So I'll move an oral amendment to strike wealth and insert weather.
Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you raised, a good point. You all know I practice law for a living, so I can negotiate for myself, but having oneself as a client is probably having the worst client of all. I've got a buddy who does residential roof contracting. If I have a weather-related claim, even though I'm capable of negotiating for myself, I'd rather have him do it, because he understands the issues a heck of a lot better than I do.
That will cease. There will be no more applause unless I say something.
I kind of liked it, Mr. Chairman.
What's the matter?
Just one more, man. Well, I think we found out why everybody's in the room. But I feel much more comfortable having Bill talk to the insurance company for me, because, and I suspect it'd go a heck of a lot faster, too, than me talking to Bill, then talking to the insurance company, then taking what the insurance company told me and going back and talking to Bill again, and then turn around, and I would just probably mess it up, because I don't know what I'm talking about. What am I missing? He'd still, under the provision here, I could still have Bill talk with the insurance company and figure out the terms of the settlement, right?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Atkins, as you look on lines 3.9 to 3.12, nothing in the section prohibits a residential contractor from discussing with an insurer the specific terms of a written contract executed between the contractor and a policyholder once the claim has been accepted by the insurer. So there's no intention to cut off the communication and the discussion between the contractor and the insurer of the individual.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, so he can just negotiate it, take care of it for me. I don't
folks,
even have to worry about it.
I'm sorry, Mac. Folks, if you could please turn your phones off, not just to silence or vibrate, just turn them off. Excuse me, Representative.
No, thank you. I'm about to turn my phone off.
Okay.
If I tell him, and I trust him, I mean, I've known him for years and years, if I tell him he's got my authority to negotiate it for me and just figure it all out, that would still be allowed?
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Atkins, again, there's no intention to cut off the communication once the contractor has been hired. What the contractor can't do, and I don't have the definition in front of me of public adjuster, is engage in the activities that this legislature has specifically put in a statute that if you do, and it lists the types of activities that a public adjuster does, then you have to have a license as a public adjuster. And so it doesn't cut off that the back and forth that needs is going to have to happen between the contractor and the insurer as that claim is being processed. What is happening is behavior above and beyond that, in writings, in letters, in communications, that not only me but regulators are saying. There was a joint bulletin issued a few years back between the Department of Labor and Industry and the Department of Commerce that went into some detail about the communication and what conduct would cross the line from the regulator's perspective to constitute public adjusting, and you can't do that without a license. So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Atkins, it's not intended to stop that, the give and take, but if you reach a line where you're holding yourself out as a public adjuster, you can't do that in Minnesota without a license.
Then, Mr. Chair and Mr. Johnson, I think you made a great point that we don't, that section probably then isn't needed. If we've already got public adjuster law, then whether somebody's violating it or not violating it isn't going to be changed by what this section says. So I'd move that we delete section 4 of the bill.
Well, what if we did this? What if we had some, and that we'll certainly come to there with some Atkins, but what if we had some testimony first? And I'd also like to see if Mr. Pender might be able to bring up the public adjuster law, because I'm sure there'll be some questions about what can public adjusters do, and they will want to see what the contractors are doing that is supposed to be crossing the line, if that's okay.
That's just fine.
Your motion will be in order in just a little bit, but I think we should take some testimony here first so members have a better idea of where we're at on this. If the gentleman who's here from New London, was it?
Spicer.
Oh, Spicer. What's their team name?
Wildcats?
I should have. Yeah, that's right. Okay. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony, please, sir.
Sure. Ken Ohl. I'm the immediate past president of the Minnesota Independent Agents Association.
How do you spell your last name?
O-H-L. I also own an independent insurance agency in Spicer, Minnesota, and been in the business for 33 years. I basically want to speak from the standpoint of how the weather-related claims are affecting independent insurance agents in Minnesota, as well as across the country. I think most of us are in support of this proposed legislation. I think there are a number of things in there that could be beneficial and help hopefully try to keep some costs down. That seems to be an issue. We've been able to travel around the Midwest over the last several years visiting companies on behalf of our insurance association to share concerns with them and also to find out what their problems are. And the number one issue that we keep hearing is about weather-related claims and how they're driving the cost of homeowners insurance and other property insurance premiums. The weather patterns have changed. I think everybody will accept that. You may be at odds as to whether the climate is changing or what's causing that, but bottom line is weather's changing. It's causing a lot of more severe claims, a lot of weather patterns that we're not used to over the last probably 50 years. Concerns that agents have are basically that we are able to maintain a marketplace for homeowners insurance and other property insurance in the state. Independent agents write a significant portion of their book of business in the line of property, specifically homeowners insurance, and it's a real difficult issue. We understand that rates need to change. We're in sync with the companies on that. We're just not quite clear on how that's going to happen. There are a lot of options. They can go to higher deductibles. They can raise rates. There are suggestions of percentage deductibles, which haven't been real popular, in the, at least in the Midwest. They've been used on the coast where there's a lot of hurricane problems. But we're... I guess we're concerned that we keep the marketplace open, and we want to make sure that this issue gets addressed so the companies have the ability to formulate rates based on the exposure that they have. We don't think this is over. This is a pattern that's going to go on for a number of years. And I think some of the responses are percentage deductibles, for example. If you're familiar with that, a percentage deductible would mean at any time you have a wind or hail loss, you would have a 1 or a 2% deductible based on the value, the replacement value of your house. Not
Mr. Earl, excuse me. Mm-hmm. Are you talking about Section 1?
It's your background. No, I'm just basically talking about the issues that other states have faced, how they've addressed it, and I think that's one of the suggestions that's been made in Minnesota is to use percentage deductibles versus a flat deductible. And I think some companies have tried that, and it didn't really pan out very well. And customers are pushing back to say, we're not interested in that. We just want to know what our deductible is right now. We're not going to buy into that logic. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, we're getting a lot of testimony on parts of the bill that don't exist anymore.
Well, I'm just...
That seems a bit odd to me. So yeah. Could you testify to the bill, maybe?
Well, again, we're in support of the bill. I don't really have a lot of issues. There was, and I don't know if this has been stricken or not, as far as surcharging for weather-related claims. I think we're opposed to that. It's worked in other states. I don't think it's going to work here. We're still Midwestern people, and we're not really probably up for that. I think the pushback will come from the marketplace, and I think, honestly, if the surcharges, but the higher deductibles and the rate changes should take care of the issue with the market. I'm not sure anything else is really necessary other than the issue with some of the other items in the bill. So.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Ohl. Any questions for Mr. Ohl? Thank you very much, sir. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on behalf of the bill as it stands now? Is there a Todd?
Yep.
Todd is here. Now, what I'd like to do, if it's okay with you, Mr. Chairman, is I'd like to take testimony on folks that are supporting your bill, and I'd like to take testimony from folks that have concerns about it.
That's fine with me.
Okay, so, Mr. Oh, they have is there anyone else who would like to testify on behalf of in support of the bill? As it is. Okay, now we'll go to folks that have concerns, I believe.
Yes, sir.
Okay, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
My name is Todd Fultz, and I am a general contractor, licensed contractor in Minnesota.
Welcome to committee, sir.
Thank you. I think where we have a concern here is the inability for us to continue to do a job that we've been doing quite well for a long time. I can appreciate Mr. Johnson's desire to have more self-regulatory control over the issues that be with their company and their ability to control the funds that they pay out. However, we feel as general contractors that the relationship that we have in our communities with the homeowners is something that's been going on for a long time. And as as Representative Atkins said, there's a certain level of business that's been done over a long period of time, and we would hate to see that go away. Specifically, what we're concerned about with what's being presented here is as Mr. Johnson was trying to eloquently explain to Mr. Atkins, the relationship between the insurance company and the contractor has been going on during the adjuster meeting for years. They've sent forth some legislation to not allow contractors to enter into what's considered public adjusting. We were okay with that. We were supportive of the deductible measures that were taken because we do not want people paying deductibles. That's the guys in our business that we are trying to avoid. The good contractors are trying to do good quality work. Where we're concerned right now is the verbiage that does not allow us to be on the property during the adjuster meeting. And that's where our major level of concern is. The insurance company is presenting it, or I think it's being presented that we're not allowed to be there during that time, and that's a concern to us. The relationship we have with the homeowner as a trusted contractor is one that we want to maintain. We are not showing up acting as a public adjuster. We are there to understand the price and scope that's being discussed with the insurance company. Because the insurance paperwork is quite vague when we get it, a lot of the decisions and a lot of the direction can be handled on that same day. I see this as an additional amount of work that would be going on. And at the end of the day, I think I can understand why the insurance company would want to have nobody there, because it gives them a little more space to work and do whatever they'd like. But I think there's certainly some checks and balances that need to be considered here. And just having somebody there on behalf of the homeowner, simply there to discuss price and scope, is what we've been doing and what we'd like to see happening. I think this bill, there's a lot of collateral damage that would come from this in the event that this goes through. And I think that needs to be considered not only in each community, but with every homeowner that's involved. And I don't think we should be damaging or taking advantage of the homeowner at this situation, especially in this economy. We're very proud to be licensed general contractors. We're represented well here. We are here to support each other, and we are here to let you know that we would like to continue moving forward with the program as it is.
Thank you, sir. Any questions for Mr. Foltz? Thank you very much, sir. Appreciate your testimony. Mr. Phil Simon. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Phil Simon. I own Simon Construction in Burnsville, Minnesota. I have 12 years experience in the construction industry. A good book of my business is retail construction. Another part is restoration work. My biggest concern about the bill as it stands now is that we're not able to get involved until the insurance company approves the loss. Sometimes it's not very clear what the loss is. Everybody has a different interpretation of what structural damage is to a shingle, window cladding, and it takes a knowledgeable professional to be able to articulate what has happened. We know storm damage will occur in the Twin Cities. Perhaps it'll be something like a tornado that went through North Minneapolis. I can remember a few years ago when the tornado went through South Minneapolis. Several adjusters wrote insurance loss data sheets that were policy limits. It takes a licensed professional to put the project back together. We are licensed by the Department of Labor and Industry. We are the only person involved in this transaction that is licensed by the Department of Labor and Industry. And I believe that this is an important part, Mr. Chamberlain. The other part is that there is a clear distinction between a public adjuster and a licensed building contractor. Traditionally, public adjusters charge 10% of the gross claim. Many Minnesotans will not be able to afford the deductible, and in addition, the 10% value that's charged to it. There will be losses that people will not be able to afford the costs and the fees associated with it. A contractor provides accountability, liability, but most importantly, also warranties the project. The state of Minnesota has been very clear that we have minimum standards, and we have a very strict warranty policy in place. The insurance adjuster does not take the phone calls when the roof leaks 2 years later. If ice and water shield is missed, it falls strictly on my shoulders. We need to be involved in the assessment process and be a part of it.
Thank you, Mr. Simon. Any questions for Mr. Simon? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Trevor Foss. And then is there anyone else that wishes to testify with concerns? We got one, two. Okay.
Want me to renew that motion again, Mr. Chairman?
I'm getting closer. Yes, we have Mr. Foss. And please, folks, as you're testifying, please, if you can just give us new information, we don't need the same information. Again, just give us anything that you can add to the discussion.
You bet.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll do the best I can on not going over things twice. My name is Trevor Foss. My wife and I, Angie Foss, own Foss Exteriors Company out of Waconia, Minnesota. I've been in this business for 30 years this summer, started with my father, so I figure I'm pretty well versed in this business by now. I prepared a little statement on my iPhone. I have my phone on airplane, so it won't affect your Siri system here. And this is my opinion. I believe that this bill is nothing more than a Trojan horse for the insurance industry to control what and who they pay. For example, over 50% of the claims that I work on are bought on a reinspection. Insurance companies pay claims because the damage is identifiable, not because the homeowner simply requests a reinspection with their contractor or just because they're trying to keep the insured happy. This bill will also attack contractors for being the problem. However, last time I checked, the weather was not in the control of the contractor and we weren't in the patterns of risk evaluation, such as an underwriter would be. I would also point out that with an overwhelming number of the adjusters and insurance companies out there, many of them are underpaid or underqualified to actually do the work that's necessary to write a claim up properly the first time. More often than not, adjusters don't have any formal construction training or experience. I do both appraisals and umpire work for insureds as well as insurance companies, and it's costly to the insured to do the appraisal process. My own property, for example, was pushed to the edge of appraisal. However, I got mine solved before that process took place. The way they have proposed this bill effectively pushes the consumer into spending more money that is not necessary. The consumer will either have to hire an appraiser, a public adjuster, they'll have to hire an attorney perhaps. For those that choose to sell their homes, this damage that would be overlooked because of the process that they've set up puts them at a disadvantage for selling their home if they don't get the damage fixed. And I think the biggest thing that I want to point out is I'm not coming at this from a contractor's point of view. I'm coming at it from a consumer's point of view. The consumer has been using contractors, as the gentleman before I said, to help them advocate getting a fair settlement that's priced and scoped correctly. And if you take us out of the process, that the contractor, the homeowner is actually at a disadvantage because now they may not have that scope and price done correctly. And he mentions, the gentleman from the Insurance Federation mentions that they're up 250%. In 1997, I believe I was paying $1.50 for diesel fuel. Today I'm paying almost $5. Weather patterns aren't going to change in the immediate future. Perhaps they will. And he also mentions that there's no deductibles. Not one of us here wants to pay a homeowner's deductible. There's no reason for us to pay the deductible. So if they want to close that loophole, let them do it. They should have done it last session, but at the last minute they had a backdoor deal, and they left a loophole in it. And that's what we're here today to do, is close that as well. Again, to reiterate, the public adjuster, there's a part in place for them. There's no question about it. I deal with them on a regular basis. You know, and they say that we can still negotiate. Like your friend, sir, is a roofing contractor. He is no longer allowed to solicit, from what I can read, a potential customer that may have damage until effectively they have an approved claim. That means that this process is slowed way down. And when you made the remarks that I believe your friend's name is Bill, just handle this. That Bill can't handle it. He's not representing you. He's representing his own company and his own needs. You just happen to be there as well as his customer, as well as the insurance company's customer. And without that tool there, if we have a major loss like we had in 1998, that storm took 2.5 years to clean up. If you allow them this process, it's going to be far longer than that to get this cleaned up. other than that, Mr. Chairman, I don't have a lot to add to it. I just think that the bill is definitely not related to contractors. I think we're the ones being pointed out. This is a consumer issue. Customers will lose out on their claims if they don't have involvement with us. If they don't have involvement with us, they're going to end up like my sister-in-law's house. She had a claim for $13,000 last year. The adjuster left saying, that's it. If your contractor wants more, tell him to call somebody else. Effectively, I got that insurance company to pay what the value was. That value went up $6,000 on one roof. How does that happen? How does a claim go from $13,000 and then all of a sudden up $6,000 if it's being looked at on the same program, the same version, of the same software? It's because our involvement of making sure that the claim gets directed the right way. And by taking us out of that equation on the front end of the claim, it just cripples the consumer.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Foss. It seems to me, though, that you are already out of the equation.
Not 100%, no, sir.
According to current law, I mean, it says here that if you advise an insured about first-party claims for losses or damages arising out of policies of insurance, then insure real or personal property for another person engaged in the business of adjusting losses or damages covered by the insurance policy for the insured. So you're out of it already. This is the public adjuster statute.
Right. If you look at the way they writ this new bill, or have written this new bill, we can only become involved after the claim has been approved.
But isn't that currently the way it is?
No, not at all. And others will testify to that, and there's other people that would like to speak as well.
But basically,
so I don't want to
take
you cannot
advise an insured about first-party claims for losses or damages.
I'm sorry, say that again.
Says you cannot advise an insured about first-party claims for losses or damages arising out of policies of insurance.
Mr. Chair, could you direct us to where you're looking?
Sure.
I'm trying to read along.
Chapter 72B, Insurance Adjusters, page 1597. And it'd be in 72B.02, definitions. It'd be item 3 right before subdivision 7. Well, it'd be subdivision 6 through 7. And look at 3 there. Directly or indirectly soliciting business investigates or just losses or advises an insurer about first-party claims. That looks to me like they're kind of locked out right now.
Well, or Mr. Chair, and I pulled it up as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that, but the point that was made, I think, best by Mr. Johnson was that this is already regulated, and you're making the same point. We don't actually need to make more laws. We got this. Look at how thick these books are already, Mr. Chairman. If that's the law that applies, and as Mr. Johnson said, there's letters that go out. If anybody oversteps and gets into the category of being a public adjuster per se and charging extra money for that service and so forth, then they're already covered by statute. Why are we, and I like belts and suspenders and all that, but I think all it's going to do is add to confusion if we adopt a different statute on top of what we already have that you just read from.
No, Representative Atkins. This is a law. We do it all the time. We pass laws to say we really mean this law.
Why don't we just
this one? We really mean this one.
Maybe we could. Okay. Perhaps we could just add an exclamation point to that 72B that you just
might do. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Foss. I hope I didn't see any trouble with it. You're already violating current statute or anything. Which be careful out there. It's a crazy old world we live in. Okay. Who else would like to get in this one? If you could come down, sir, please. Sir, if you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Absolutely. Mr. Chairman, Honorable Committee, my name is Chris Parrington. I'm an attorney in the Twin Cities with the law firm of Schold Parrington.
Parrington with a P?
Parrington, P-A-R-R-I-N-G-T-O-N.
Thank you very much, sir.
I apologize to the Honorable Committee for my attire, given the mistyped title of this bill. I did not realize that this committee was meeting to discuss weather-related claims. It was not my intention to appear in front of this committee without a suit and tie, so I apologize for that.
I do it all the time.
I don't really want to have my name.
Mr. Chair, this is the
Rick
house.
Nelson?
This is the house, and we don't have those minor things. We don't have those dress codes here. In the Senate, you might have to have the wig and the tie.
Oh, wonderful.
Okay, now we'd like to hear your testimony other than Section 1.
Absolutely.
Because that's not here.
I come here from a little different of a position. I have a significant practice representing homeowners in first-party claims. And I think that this bill would be devastating to homeowners in Minnesota. And I really want to address, Representative Atkins asked Mr. Johnson if what The scenario was with his buddy. I have a contractor friend. He knows the business. He knows the parts. He knows the products. He knows the procedures. Why couldn't I just, or could I have him do this? And Mr. Johnson did a wonderful job of tap dancing around that issue, but Representative Atkins' answer is no. Under this bill, that could not occur. Under Section 4, contractors are explicitly forbidden from being part of the process until the claim is paid. The problem with that is homeowners today already have a significant number of roadblocks, whether it's getting the claim filed on time, getting copies of policies, getting into an appraisal process, getting an umpire appointed through the appraisal process. There is hurdle after hurdle for homeowners. What this bill will do, which I think is different from the public adjuster bill that's been discussed so far, is this bill will give the insurance companies ammunition to create a wedge between a homeowner and a contractor. The subdivision 2 of Section 4, the private remedy, specifically says that to an extent a contractor engages in conduct in violation of subdivision 1A, then the homeowner would have a claim against the contractor. The insured would have a claim. I can tell you from my experience representing homeowners, what would happen is a contractor would get involved in the process. The insurance company would then deny the claim and say, by the way, though, your contractor violated the statute. You want to get money? Go after your contractor. Go after them under the private remedy statute. There is a provision in the statute right now, and trust me, as a trial lawyer, as a litigator, I'm a big fan of additional laws, new litigation. But at the end of the day, we need to look from the position of the homeowners, the position of the consumers. Consumers don't know roofs. Consumers don't know weather. Consumers don't know damage. Consumers don't know policies. That's why we have independent public adjusters, to help with policy issues. That's why contractors have to remain in this procedure, so that they can deal with the construction side of it, so that they can advise homeowners, they can have discussions on things like matching, discussions on things like the extent of damage, discussion on things like how you identify damage to shingles. Homeowners cannot do that, and the insurance lobby and the insurance industry knows that, and that's why they don't want contractors involved, because then they can take advantage of the homeowners. I think that this bill is nothing more than a wolf in sheep's clothing, and I think it will be absolutely devastating to my clients, the homeowners of Minnesota.
But Mr. No. Don't go there. Don't do that.
They can only applaud me, Mr. Chair. Isn't that the rule? Oh, it's you. I'm sorry.
Okay, Mr. Parrington, but isn't it true that a lot of contractors may be violating the public adjuster statute right now?
That may be the case, and there's a law in place that will deal with that. But you got to understand the difference between what public adjusters do in the process and what contractors do. Public adjusters assist homeowners with policy issues. Is this covered under the policy? Do you have a lost rent portion of your policy? Do you have a personal property provision? But they can't write scopes. They can't write bids. They don't know the costs of replacing, repairing the damage. That's where the contractor becomes valuable. And so what you really need to do is have a definition of what is adjusting, what is not adjusting. And that's what I think the public adjuster bill does. But to just completely cut contractors out of this procedure will be absolutely devastating to homeowners, because then you won't have people in the industry familiar with pricing, familiar with bids, that can give real honest bids and estimates to homeowners and say, hey, you know what, this insurance company, they're only giving you enough to replace some damaged shingles, but I'm telling you right now, you got to replace your whole roof. And adjusters, they can talk policy, but they can't give you the bids. They can't give you the numbers on that. That's where the contractors need to be involved.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Questions for Mr. Parrington? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Parrington, so in your view, and I'm listening to, as I was listening to the earlier testimony and from the testimony from Mr. Johnson, who's going to be left holding the bag if this bill passes? Is it going to be the homeowner? Is it going to be the insurance company? I mean, Mr. Johnson talked about weather and the cost of the number of claims going up, but if this bill passes, who's going to be left holding the bag?
The homeowner will.
Mr. Parrington?
The homeowner absolutely will be, and I'll explain why. Right now, contractors, if they are allowed to continue being involved in the claim, the reward for the contractor is they get the job, they get to do the roof. If you have a contractor who's not allowed to be involved in part of the process, then they need to go to an adjuster, and a typical adjuster takes a percentage of the claim, which then means the homeowner, one, is paying a deductible, and two, is left at the end of the day without enough money to actually replace the damage. Now, if you get an aggressive insurance company who decides they want to go a step further, they're stuck hiring somebody like me. Now they're stuck paying out of pocket for legal fees. They got a loss of a cut of the claim on an adjuster. The homeowner loses out. Whereas if you can keep the contractor involved in the process and the procedure, the loss to the homeowner is not that significant. And to the extent you have insurance companies thinking that a contractor is stepping over the line, as the first testifier said, you have remedies already in the public adjuster statute.
Representative Nelson?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm thinking of a house in my district that had some storm damage, and it's still 5 years later not fixed because the insurance company never paid enough for the owner to fix the project or fix the home. And so I guess I'm just I got concerns about this as a carpenter myself, and who works has worked in the construction field for over 30 years. It's, you know, when adjusters come forward and say that this is how much it's going to cost and they don't know the true value, and then the homeowner's not going to get enough money out of it, and they're going to be left holding a bag, not being able to fix their home. I have concerns about this.
Well, Representative Nelson, could you give your constituent's name to Mr. Parrington? If he'd wear a tie.
I wear a tie in front of a robe, I will say that.
any other questions for Mr. Parrington? Okay, thank you, Mr. Parrington.
Thank
very
you, Mr.
Helpful.
Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee.
Where'd the author of the bill go? Oh, okay. I thought, man. Okay. Please join us, sir. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Sure. My name is Jim Dvorak. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Exterior Specialists.
Can you please spell your last name?
D as in David, V as in Victor, O-R-A-K.
Okay, thank you, sir. Please present your testimony.
Okay, we just wanted to state a position that we believe this bill to be adversarial to the consumers and to the contractors. And we would like Section 4, we second the motion to strike that. So,
sir, motions don't require a second, and you can't make one.
Okay, I know.
Okay, so.
We're in favor of that, though.
Any questions for the witness? Okay, thank you, sir. The gentleman, if you could come down, please, sir. Please state your name for the record and who you represent, please, sir.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name's Don Huizenga. Last name is H-U-I-Z-E-N-G-A. I'm the National Commercial Manager for American Building Contractors from Burnsville, Minnesota. We are a local company headquartered here, but we're a national company. We deal with large loss claims or apartment multifamily claims all across the country. I run the division that tackles a lot of those claims. What I want to add to this discussion really is kind of a brief history of the size of the claims sometimes that we deal with an insurance company, where if the contractor isn't present, we're not just dealing with a homeowner, but we're dealing with multiple homeowners. I've settled claims in Minnesota that have been $12 and $13 million that have covered over 800 units of rehab, for instance, in the Hugo tornado. I've also settled claims in Florida from hurricanes. I've done claims of every size and every project. One of the advantages that our clients have and that the homeowners associations have with hiring a qualified contractor is that contractor is able to assess large volumes of scope and things that most of the insurance adjusters miss. We did the claim in 2008 in Hugo, Minnesota from the tornado. One of the things that happened was the insurance company was actually writing the scope while we were repairing the property because there was windows blown out, there was safety issues, there was garage doors missing. So there's a lot of things that had to actually be repaired while the claim was actually being written. So from the contractor standpoint, we get in positions sometimes where we're accepting all of the loss and all of the financial responsibility because there's been no payment made from the insurance company. So what happens is we're rehabbing and buttoning up 800 units of townhome. The insurance company is dragging their feet literally on actually writing any kind of claim at all. And when the claim does come, it's entirely inaccurate. The Homeowners Association has no ability whatsoever to decipher 6,000 pages of claim paperwork and scope paperwork. we don't settle the claims in terms of what the policies read. We settle the claims in terms of what's actually on the property. There's 100 squares of roofing on this building. If the insurance company only pays for 20, we need to know that, because we don't want to replace 100 square roof and only get paid for 20 squares of roofing. A lot of times the insurance companies will say, well, you know, we're going to replace the whole roof, but we think the roof is 80 squares. If I go up there and the roof is 100 squares, I need to be able to communicate that to the insurance adjuster, that the roof is 100 squares and not 80. If we can't do that, even before the claim or while the claim's in process, then you'll have situations where contractors will put on 80 squares of roofing and leave the other 20 squares alone and tell the homeowner, you're going to have to go deal with your insurance company yourself. And they're going to completely lack the ability to do so. So it's not just single-family homes. There's large townhome properties and apartment properties in Minnesota that utilize the same services of a qualified contractor to help determine the extent of the scope of damage on their properties. And that's where the co-joining with the insurance adjuster actually takes place. I've been doing this for 15 years all over the country. I know a lot of adjusters, both independents and staffs. I've never taken a claim to appraisal in all my years, with the exception of the last 2 years. And that's really the fault of the insurance companies. They've been delaying payments. They don't want to make payments. They underpay claims. And it really leaves the homeowners in a bad situation. There's a homeowners association right now at Weston Woods and Savage that had tarps on their roof for 2 years, suffering water damage every year because an insurance company doesn't want to help them, and the association has no recourse but to use me as a contractor that has some knowledge to say, this is where we need to go, this is the damage to your roof, and submit it to the insurance company. So we have to be able to educate our homeowners on the damage, the extent of the damage to the property, sometimes even before the insurance adjuster gets there. That's what I would say.
Thank you, Mr. Huizinga. Any questions for Mr. Huizinga? Mr. Chairman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we have a plan. Clearly, there are a lot of problems with Section 4 of the bill, and Representative Atkins made an amendment to take that section out. I've talked to Mr. Johnson from the Insurance Federation and Representative Atkins and others, and I think if Representative Atkins will accede to this, I think what we're going to do is, in an interest of saving time, I don't know where we were planning to send this general register, pass this bill, and then guarantee that it's not moving anywhere else until the contractors and the insurance. Originally, Section 4 was language that was suggested or put in by the Commerce Department, and I thought this was going to be the elusive, often looked for, not always achieved peace in the valley language. Clearly, it's not. So I think what we will do is let Mr. Johnson and the folks on the other side come to a conclusion that hopefully we can get to a conclusion that Representative Atkins and I and the rest of the committee members are going to be okay with. And we'll let them go work on it. And if they can't come up with it, then we just don't move the bill. But hopefully we can find something that works. I think the spirit of the amendment or of the bill is right. We just need to make sure that we're not disadvantaging our homeowners or the contractors.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what about, so are you suggesting there be a motion from Representative Atkins to delete Section 4 or pass the bill as is and nothing else happens?
Well, that's what I'm hoping we can do, is pass the bill and it will go to the general register and it won't move, it won't get heard, nothing will happen except negotiations where we can get the parties together, Mr. Johnson and the contractors. And I mean, the Builders Association is okay with the bill as is, but maybe we can come up with ways to make the language palatable to everybody. And if we can't, we'll just let it sit on the general register and never hear it again.
But what if things wouldn't go the way everybody wants? Would you then maybe get rid of Section 4 and pass the other provisions of the bill?
Possibly, if that's something that we could come to agreement with. But okay. I thought that this was comfort language, and if we can't find that place where we have peace in the valley, you know, then we'll have to go back to the drawing board.
Representative Atkins?
Mr. Chairman, and if I didn't have such respect, and I genuinely mean this, I've been kind of making some funny comments or attempted funny comments here and there, but I have the utmost respect for Chairman Hoppe. If he gives his word, and he has, this bill goes to the general register and will not be seen or heard from again until there's some agreement worked out with respect to Section 4, I can live with that, and I would withdraw my amendment. I would have Two other quick comments, however.
Certainly.
One is, I still don't like the bill and would suggest a no vote. There is nothing in here. If it's going to save a bunch of money for our insurance companies, then those savings ought to be passed along to the insured. And my guess is that the bill wouldn't be pursued if it wasn't going to save somebody like insurance companies some money, right? But there's nothing in the bill that provides for that. And I would suggest that before the bill come to the floor, that there be a provision in there, too, that if there is going to, in fact, be some savings, that it ought to be the insured that we look out for, and that they be entitled to some of the savings as well. With those two items, and then one final clarification, and that is speaking, and I shouldn't for the Department of Commerce, they can speak for themselves, but let's not lay off this language on the department. I think the department was doing their best to try to find more suitable language, but it was in the original bill, as I saw, and it's not something the Department of Commerce came up with. It's something the Insurance Federation of Minnesota came up with. If the department should remain involved, and I would expect that they would, I would suggest that they and the roofers and the Insurance Federation try to figure out something that is in the homeowner's best interest, not the insurance companies or legislators or anybody else, but those homeowners that purchase these policies. With that, Mr. Chairman, I've exhausted my comments, and I appreciate your indulgence.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. Representative Mullery.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm a little concerned about that, and maybe Representative Atkins has got a more thorough agreement than I've heard, but just having an agreement between adjusters, contractors, insurers does not protect homeowners, which I'm very worried about, who are also part of this. And so having some of the players agree on it and then moving it forward does not satisfy me that all important parties in my book are part of it. So unless Representative Atkins says that that's part of the agreement, that some of us that would see a problem with homeowners could stop the bill, I don't think we should be passing it out of here without hearing what might come back and its effect on homeowners.
On
that point, if I was trying to cover several items, if I failed to say that fully, that absolutely is my sense. But I'll leave it to Chairman Hoppe that homeowners ought to have a seat at that table as well.
Representative Mullery, you still have the floor, sir.
Mr. Chairman, if that's the author's intent, then I have no problem with it. But I just want to make sure that when we're concerned about people, that it not be just some of the players agreed to.
Chairman Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Mullery, when and if the elusive peace in the valley is achieved, we'll bring you the bill, and you can look at it and be looking out for homeowners. I think that's everybody's intention.
Further discussion to the bill as amended?
Just we'd prefer a roll call, Mr. Chairman.
A roll call being requested. There will be a roll call. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I too respect Representative Hoppe and his word, but I just the Representative Pawlowski, who used to be chair of the Government Operations Committee, always used to harp on we should be doing committee work in committee and not on the floor of the House. And like I said, while I do respect Representative Hoppe, I think I would prefer if we were to lay it over and let the work be done and then pass it out of here and do our work in committee as opposed to having it down the floor. And just saying that as a comment, I know Representative Hoppe is a man of his word and will work on this even though it's on the general register.
So you're not making a motion to lay it over at this point? Okay. Any other comments or questions? Okay. Representative Hoppe renews his motion that House File 2553 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the general register. The Committee of Legislative Assistance will take the roll.
Hoppe.
Aye.
Sanders.
Aye.
Atkins.
No.
Diane Anderson.
Aye.
Sarah Anderson.
Aye.
Crawford.
Aye.
Doubt.
Yes.
Davids.
Yes.
Dietrich.
No.
Johnson.
No.
Kiefer.
Yes.
Lilly.
No.
Loon.
Aye.
Mazerell.
Yes.
Mullery.
No.
Murdoch.
Yes.
Nelson.
No.
O'Driscoll.
Yes.
Slocum.
No.
Stensrud.
Yes.
Tilbury.
There being 13 ayes and 7 nays, the motion is adopted. Item next, House File 2356, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Thanks for your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Practicing his parental skills.
Hey, members, we will just wait a second here to allow folks.
When all these bodies are out.
I think we're doing like the most stupid parenting thing I've ever seen in my life. Letting our crowd
Representative Dowd, you want to go ahead when you're ready, move your bill, and please proceed?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. I would move that House File 2356 be recommended to pass and referred to the Civil Law and Data Practices Subcommittee.
Thank you, Representative Dowd. I see we have visitors. Whoever, I'm not sure who's going first, but please introduce yourself for the record and proceed, unless Representative Dowd, unless you want to start us out.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if that's okay, I've actually got an amendment that I'd like to offer to get this bill into the order that we would like. And hot off the press is the H3 amendment.
Representative Dowd, do you want to explain briefly what the A3 amendment is?
Certainly. Right now, the WCRA board is made up of 13 members, two of which come from the self-insurer groups. I shouldn't use the word groups. That'll be a little confusing. What this amendment would do would bump that up by one. Two members would stay with the individual self-insurers, and one member would come from the group self-insurers. This basically is a change that I think since this statute was passed, I think it dates back to the late 70s actually, that at that point there were no group self-insurers, so we're just adding some representation for that group on the board of directors. And it's my understanding that their book of business with the WCRA, the individual self-insureds have about 21% of the business, and the group self-insureds have about 6% of the business. Together right now, they've got two board members. This would bump that up to three. So they together have 27% of the business with the WCRA, and this would give them 21% of representation on the board. So it's just bringing a little more in line with their amount of business they do with the WCRA.
Thank you, Representative Dowd. Members, any questions? Is there anyone in the audience that wants to speak for or against this particular amendment? Seeing nobody rushing down, we will...
You guys are welcome.
Please come down and... Well, do you need to speak to the amendment, or can you wait and speak to the bill generally after we adopt the amendment? Well, go ahead and speak to the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Buzz Cummins. I'm president of the Workers' Compensation Reinsurance Association. I haven't seen the amendment. I've heard it described. It makes a fairly fundamental change in the composition of our board of directors, which has been in place since 1985. Our board is composed of four insurance company representatives, two self-insurer representatives, two insured employer representatives, two state officials, two union officials, and one public member. And this, I would consider to be a fairly material change in the composition of our board. I can see that our board might be concerned enough about it that some of our other board members would want to add additional members to their particular interest group. I would urge the committee to defer a decision on this one, at least until I have an opportunity to talk to my board about it. But I will urge you to do what I was going to urge you to do on the main bill anyway, and it has been done with WCRA-related legislation in the past, and that is to, because it does constitute a change to the workers' comp system, to refer this matter for consideration by Representative Kiefer and her associates on the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council, which is charged with looking at all these sorts of issues. So that is my piece on this particular amendment, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cummins. Members, any questions for Mr. Cummins? Seeing none, we will vote on the A3 amendment. Representative Dowd.
I believe that Jim LaRoy and Robin Sykes would like to speak in favor of the amendment.
Okay.
My name is Jim LaRoy. I'm the president of the Minnesota Self-Insured Group Association and senior vice president of Meadowbrook Insurance Group. We are a third-party administrator and administrator for self-insured workers' compensation groups and public entity trusts in the state of Minnesota. These groups, the Self-Insured Group Association, is comprised of over 1,000 employers in the state of Minnesota, employing over 20,000 employees in the manufacturing, construction, and healthcare industries, and represent in excess of $1.5 billion of payroll. When the WCRA was formed, group self-insurance for workers' compensation didn't exist in the state of Minnesota, and an organization the use of group self-insurance for providing workers' compensation has grown between the group self-insureds and the public entity trusts. They now represent approximately a third of the self-insured employers in the state on an exposure basis, on a payroll basis, essentially. And there has been no representation assured in the statute for these types of entities that did not exist when the statute was passed. And they say that an organization really is tested when it goes under stress. And a couple of years ago, when the WCRA was confronted with the need to assess its members something north of $400 million, on behalf of the self-insured group employers in the state, we worked and attempted to work with the WCRA discussing the method that assessment was going to be done. We attempted to work through the elected representatives who are designated for self-insureds generally, but are elected by the individual self-insureds on the members of the WCRA. And without going into details, that that representation we considered pretty inadequate with respect to addressing the needs expressed by Minnesota's employers through us. And for that reason, we're here looking for an amendment to the statute that would provide guaranteed representation on the board of directors and presentation of the interests of these employers, smaller employers, multiple thousands of employers, on behalf of their interests with the WCRA. And for that reason, I support the amendment for getting representation on the board through the addition of another member.
Thank you, Mr. LaRoy. Ma'am, do you want to speak to the amendment?
No.
Okay. Any questions, members? Seeing none, we will vote on the A3 amendment. All those in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails. The A3 amendment is adopted. Representative Dowd, to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This bill basically aims to do a few things. Number one, bring the WCRA under the – I apologize about all these acronyms. They're new for me, too. My joke was going to be that until this morning I thought we were dealing with the WCHA here. As much as Minnesota likes hockey, that might be a little more exciting than this, but it is an important issue nonetheless.
Representative Dell, we're glad you didn't make that joke.
Thank you. but it is an important issue nonetheless. The WCRA obviously deals with large amounts of money through this workers' comp reinsurance. And a lot of that money is public money through these different organizations. So, number one, the bill would make the WCRA subject to the open meeting law requirements. Number two, also subject to the data practices requirements. And then number three is the amendment that we added that would expand the board by one member to allow the group self-insurers to have representation on the board of directors. So very simply, that's the three things that this bill does.
And ma'am, did you want to speak to the bill?
Yes, I do.
Please identify yourself for the record and
sure.
Start when you're ready.
My name is Robin Sykes, and I'm the executive director of the Minnesota...
Ma'am, could you spell your last name?
Sure, S-Y-K-E-S. And I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Counties Intergovernmental Trust. MCIT is a joint powers public entity risk sharing pool formed pursuant to Minnesota Statute 47159, which is the joint powers statute in the state of Minnesota. MCIT presently represents 81 of Minnesota's 87 counties. The large six counties like Anoka, Hennepin, Ramsey, St. Louis, Dakota, and Olmsted are not members of MCIT, but all of the greater Minnesota counties all participate in MCIT. We also represent about 360 other associated public entities. So when you look across your counties and you think about the library or the county fair, a judicial ditch, any of those other joint powers, most of those related to counties are also participating in MCIT. We've been around since 1979. Oddly enough, it's about the same year that WCRA was created, primarily for the same reason. It was a hardening in the insurance market, particularly relative to workers' compensation. Counties were finding themselves having their premiums prohibitively priced or being canceled, and they looked for alternatives to the traditional insurance market. MCIT was formed in 79. We provide property casualty liability or property casualty and work comp coverage for all of our members. The MCIT, when it was organized, was under the auspices of the Association of Minnesota Counties, and county commissioners came together and said, you know, if we're going to form an organization, there's a lot of ways that we could form, but we believe the most effective one and the one we know best is to form as a public entity. And so MCIT functions as if we are the 88th county in the state of Minnesota. I run my board meetings and my organization just like a county administrator would a county. We're subject to the open meeting law, data practices, veterans preference. We're obligated to limit our investments to 118A, which is very prescriptive and not risky at all. And we're also subject to ensure that we get the best deal for the dollars that our constituents pay, and that means that we're subject to the municipal bid law. The concept of joint self-insurance basically allows our members to pool those their resources to pay for the claims that we see, to pay for the administration. We also offer risk management and loss control. And the other really big ticket item for MCIT is the cost of reinsurance. Our membership in the WCRA is about 10% of what I charge back to the counties in the state of Minnesota. And please keep in mind that when every county commissioner or county sends their checks to MCIT for contribution, that is paid by all of us sitting in the room every time you walk up to the treasurer's window and you pay your property taxes. So this has a direct impact on everybody in the state of Minnesota. And it is this issue of reinsurance that brings me to the hearing today to testify in support of House File 2356. The WCRA is a state-created mandatory monopoly that requires all insurers, self-insurers, joint insurers, and public trusts to buy their reinsurance from the WCRA. We are legally prohibited from seeking competitive pricing for this coverage. I can go nowhere else to purchase this coverage. In 2009, the WCRA announced that because their investments in the stock market, they're again held to no limitations on how they roll the dice with the investments or the dollars of their members, had not performed as expected, and that they were moving to assess or tax the members to ensure that they were financially stable. In response to this announcement, MCIT asked for information related to those decisions that would require counties and other public entities in the state to pay more money to the WCRA. We were denied access to that data. We were denied access to the board meetings where they deliberated and discussed that data. And as a result, we asked for that and were told that as a nonprofit entity, they were not subject to the certain parameters that I, as a public entity, open meeting and data practices are subject to. I come in support of this bill as a simple matter of good government. The WCRA extracts millions of dollars from public entities, counties, cities, school districts, townships, and even the state of Minnesota, and we are all obligated to do our due diligence when we're spending money to our constituents. The reason that we need to have access to that information to justify what we're asking our members to pay to this organization. The members are denied access to WCRA meetings where the board considers data and deliberates issues that translate into the use of tax dollars for their investments and operations. Given that its members are held hostage, they call us members, but I consider it being a hostage, it only makes sense that the WCRA should be required to operate with the same degree of transparency as its public entity members, and I would suggest that the same level of transparency should be afforded to all members, given the monopoly of the WCRA. Presently, the WCRA operates pursuant to its own operational guidelines that can be simply changed at the discretion of its board. The WCRA operates without anyone knowing how it does business. It is immune from competition and is subject to only minimal regulation and oversight by the State Department of Labor and Industry and Commerce. It does not have limitations on its investment practices, thereby allowing it to invest in financial instruments regardless of how risky those are. And if they lose money in those investments, they can simply assess or tax the hostages or the membership. Inherent in the monopoly of the WCRA entities, we are unable to test the traditional insurance market to ensure that they are truly competitive. Public entities like mine have absolutely no ability to opt out. We are stewards of taxpayer dollars and have an obligation to ensure its proper use by observing the deliberations of the WCRA board and their directors and having our views expressed pursuant to those provisions under the Open Meeting Law and the Data Practices Act. I believe that this legislature has the authority and I believe an absolute responsibility to require that the WCRA be subject to the Open Meeting Law and the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act to protect the citizens of the state. Therefore, I would simply ask for your support in the passage of House File 2356. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sykes. Members, any questions? Seeing no questions, Mr. Cummins, did you want to come down and speak to the bill as amendment? Is there anyone else that wants to speak for or against the bill? Mr. Cummins, welcome back.
Delighted to be here, Mr. Chairman. Again, I'm Buzz Cummins, president of the WCRA. It has been at least 4 or 5 years since any kind of legislation related to our organization has been in front of the committee, so I have a sneaky feeling there are some members here who don't really know what we do, so if I could take just a moment to briefly explain it. We were formed in 1979, authorized by the legislature. We provide reinsurance for serious workers' compensation claims for all insurers and self-insurers in the state of Minnesota. Basically, what that amounts to is all of the insurers and self-insurers buy coverage from us to pay claims that exceed a selected retention limit that they may have. Right now, we have three retention limits available: $460,000, $920,000, and $1,840,000. So once the losses on a claim exceed that amount, our member companies report the claim to us, and we start reimbursing them. And we generally reimburse them within 1 day of the time. If they give us a completed record on what the claim payments have been, we reimburse them almost immediately. So we operate a little bit differently than a lot of private reinsurance companies who like to haggle over claims. But we don't generally have to do that. We charge our member companies a premium. And we pay all of their losses that exceed their retention limit to the sky. In other words, if they've got a $1,940,000 retention limit and they have an $80 million claim, we'll pay $78,160,000 or whatever the number is. So we are on the hook for liabilities as large as they may be on any particular claim. There is no coverage like that available in any other state in the United States. So we are a unique organization in that respect. We are also unique in that we have our own section of the Internal Revenue Code. The Congress has recognized us as a 501c27a tax-exempt organization. So we're really kind of unique. We're the only one in the country. We also are the only reinsurance fund or company in the country that is covered under the Federal Terrorism Risk Insurance Act, so that all of our members, including our self-insured members, have protection in the event of a terrorist attack here in Minnesota. So we are a unique kind of organization. Let me emphasize a couple of points. When we were created, the business community in this state insisted that we not be a state agency. They wanted us to follow more of a corporate model. They didn't want to create another state bureaucracy. So they created us as a nonprofit entity. They authorized us to incorporate under the state's nonprofit statutes, which we have not chosen to do over the years. But for the last 32 years, we have been an unincorporated tax-exempt association. Tax-exempt association, because the business community wanted it that way. We have never received any state appropriations for our operations, not from day one. Organizations like Ms. Sykes's are members of ours. They pay us a premium. The state of Minnesota is self-insured for workers' comp. They pay us a premium. Target Corporation is self-insured for workers' comp. They pay us a premium. Everybody pays on the same basis, whether they're government, whether they're group, whether they're private. And since the day we've been formed, because we are not a state agency, we have been exempt from chapters 13, 13D, 14, and 15. And obviously the main bill that was in front of you before the amendment would make us subject to the open meeting law and to the Data Practices Act. I already mentioned to you that I was concerned about the amendment adding a 14th board member. We have two labor representatives, for example, on our board who may feel that, well, if they're increasing the number of business and insurance representatives on the WCRA board, maybe we need another representative. If the insurers decide that maybe the self-insurers are suddenly overrepresented, maybe they will want another representative. I have to talk these issues over with my board before I could ever consider signing off on it. And I would consider that a major structural change to the WCRA. I think it's important for the board to, or for the committee to understand who it is that is authoring this bill or proposing this bill. It isn't the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce or the business community. It isn't the Minnesota Insurance Federation or the insurers. It isn't the it isn't organized labor. It isn't the Minnesota Self-Insurers Association. It isn't our regulator, the Commissioner of Labor and Industry, who's proposing this change. It is essentially two of our member companies out of 650 member companies. They have a bone to pick with us. They have not been happy with some of the things that we've done. We have tried to accommodate and address their concerns. We have given them seats on a couple of our internal advisory committees. We've met with them repeatedly. I don't think we have ever denied them any data that they have asked for. Ms. Sykes might disagree, but my recollection or my understanding is that any data they've asked for, they've received from us. We think we have gone a great distance to try to accommodate their concerns. But basically, they want their own appointee on the board of directors, even though they don't represent a significant portion of our membership. So, with that in mind, let me just say one or two words about the Data Practices Act and the open meeting law. I'll make this very brief, Mr. Chairman. The Data Practices Act applies to government entities, according to Chapter 1301. It defines a government entity as a state agency, which we are not. It defines or a political subdivision, which we are not, or a statewide system. And it goes on to define a statewide system as a record-keeping system in which government data is collected. We don't collect any government data. So while they may want to make us subject to the Data Practices Act, it simply by its own terms doesn't apply to us. With respect to the open meeting law, it applies to executive branch agencies, local governments, school districts, counties, statutory or home rule cities, towns, a statewide public pension plan, a local public pension plan. We are none of those things. it simply, the shoe doesn't fit, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and we would ask you to not advance the bill. In fact, I would renew my suggestion, which I made earlier, because we do have some significant differences of opinion here with the two proponents of this bill, that this is the kind of issue that the Work Comp Advisory Council was formed for. And I would suggest that the committee consider referring the matter to the Work Comp Advisory Committee for its study and for a recommendation back to the committee and to the legislature.
Thank you, Mr. Cummins.
Thank you very much.
Members, any questions? Mr. Representative Atkins.
And I apologize for stepping out for a few minutes, but did the chief author talk about that suggestion? I shared it with proponents and opponents earlier when they came to visit with me about the Work Comp Advisory Board. Is that something that makes sense?
Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Atkins, I'm not sure I heard what you said. Could you repeat that?
Representative
Atkins. The whole thing? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dowd. Mr. Cummins talked about perhaps this is an issue that might go to the Work Comp Advisory Board. Is that something that you've... And the, part of the reason I shared this with the proponents and opponents, what makes me nervous is anytime Work Comps comes to the floor of the House, it can be a real doozy of an issue. And that's why we had the Work Comp Advisory Board. This may or may not be an issue that's perfect for that board, but anytime a Work Comp issue comes up, and Michael Nelson, Representative Nelson, is nodding his head, it can be a real doozy of an issue because there's all kinds of amendments that come up, and anybody that's been here more than about 15 minutes recognizes that. I'm a little afraid that this might become that sort of issue if it comes to the floor that way. Is that something the chief author or the proponents have given some thought to?
Representative Dowd.
I think Ms. Sykes might want to comment on that.
Ms. Sykes.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think it's very important to understand that the Work Comp Advisory, the purview for that group has to do with benefits under 176, which is clearly a distinctive activity or role that they play. What we are asking for is to look at the issues related to the governance of the WCRA. And I can share with you that we're already having discussions with the Work Comp Advisory Council relative to making them understand we are not looking at making any modifications to benefits. That is not what this bill is about. This bill would simply allow those of us or anybody who's paying into the WCRA an opportunity to see how the dollars that we are paying in and the money that we're getting from our constituents is being used. So, I mean, that would be, I think it's two totally different things. And I can appreciate the fact of, you know, the concern was, well, does this have to go through some of these other committees relative to data practices and open meeting? We're not proposing changes to either of those statutes. We're simply saying that we'd like to make the WCRA subject. However, as Mr. Cummins points out, maybe there does have to be some modification to those two statutes to insert WCRA as meeting those definitions. But I see that some of that being a little bit different, the role of the advisory committee, and that may just be a way to obstruct moving this forward.
Representative Atkins.
And Ms. Chair and Ms. Sykes, I'm certainly not trying to obstruct anything, but I do know that may be the purview of the Work Comp Advisory Council. I know that the legislature feels no need to limit itself to any purview when bills come to the floor. And so I am a little afraid that Work Comp is really one of those hot button kinds of issues, and regardless of whether it's affecting benefits or not, a bill like this comes to the floor and you just, you know, it's a box of chocolates. You don't quite know what you're going to get when it comes out, and that concerns me a little bit. So I just raise it for the sake of discussion and for the chief author to maybe give some thought to. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can we hear from the Department of Labor and Industry or from John Rakowski, who's also involved with the Work Comp Advisory Council? I'd also like to hear from someone maybe with some legal expertise on if it is germane, if this bill is germane to Section 176.
Thank you, Representative Kiefer. Mr. Rakowski is coming down right now, and I don't know if I mentioned this in the motion earlier, but if we pass this, the motion is to send it to civil law. So I don't want any more mentions of the word legal in here. Mr. Rakowski.
Mr. Chairman, I'm John Rakowski with the Department of Labor and Industry. I understand Ms. Sykes has had conversation electronically and verbally with the commissioner. A little bit of both. The commissioner told me yesterday that he would like to, as we do with most pieces of legislation that get tossed around up here, contemplated. His first, the first thing my Commissioner Kim Peterson does is try to get in contact with David Olson of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and Cher Knutson with the AFL-CIO, because they are the permanent statutory co-chairs of the Work Comp Advisory Council. And Commissioner Peterson's en route to Granite Falls right now for Senator Kubley's wake. I asked if he could try to get an answer for you folks from the representatives of labor and from labor and from the chamber. This isn't an issue that they're not unfamiliar with. Does
Thank
that
you.
Help anyone?
Thank you, Mr. Rakowski. Representative Anderson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And if Mr. Rakowski could remain there. You know, one of the suggestions was is having the Work Comp Advisory Board handle this. But what authority do they have over WCRA, if any?
Mr. Rakowski.
I've only had a little bit of with the previous commissioner. This issue came up with the previous commissioner, Swigum, as well. And there, I attended a meeting with Mr. Cummins, and I believe you were also at the meeting 2 years ago. So this issue's been around for a while. The fact that they set their work comp premiums, you know, is subject to people come and complain to people bring their issues in front of the Work Comp Advisory Council, both regarding their benefits, injured workers often come, but also whether businesses are paying too much. Senator Peterson from St. Cloud came in front of the council just last month and wanted to know why his rates went up last year when he had no reportable injuries. We directed him to the Department of Commerce. For those of you who are still relatively new, I get calls a lot about why are my work comp rates so high, because we manage the benefit system, but it's the Department of Commerce that actually sets the premiums and your experience ratings, right? Maybe you might know.
Representative Anderson, does that answer your question?
Well, it sounds to me that you don't really have any authority over them. It's just more of we would hope that you do that. Is that kind of the gist of it? Or?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, if I may. We are regulated by the Commissioner of Labor and Industry, so he has pretty absolute authority over us. He appoints five of our board members. He has to approve the election of the other of six other board members. He regulates our rates. He and the Commissioner of Commerce had to approve our assessments. They have to approve any surplus distributions we make. So they have extensive authority over us under Chapter 176, in addition to which we paid $76 million in benefits last year under Chapter 176 for workers' comp indemnity and health care costs. So we are inextricably intertwined with Chapter 176.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Cummins, you know, I'm just curious. Forgive me if I missed this earlier. Why are you opposed to having greater transparency and having open meeting law and so forth?
Mr. Cummins.
We have a significant amount of transparency as it is. We don't necessarily want to open up our meetings to the general public. Our board discusses personnel issues, discusses legal issues, discusses complex actuarial issues. You know, our board would simply prefer to continue to operate as they have for 32 years. It has not been an issue with other members prior to this. These are the only two members who have raised this issue during my 18 years at the WCRA. So it has not been a major problem for the vast majority of our members.
Representative Anderson.
I won't say any more.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And having served up until this year on the Work Comp Advisory Board, all sorts of issues come up, as it was brought up here. Labor brings issues about benefits and people not being paid properly in the management side. The chamber brings up issues about the cost of the insurance premiums, and both sides try to work together through many of these issues like this on the board to try and come to a peace in the valley, so that we're bringing forth stuff that'll move the ball forward and not end up on the as a fight in the legislature about who's in charge at any certain time, and in effect hurt injured workers more than they already are. But I have a question, I guess, and maybe just a comment. What other, I mean, there was talk earlier about the reason they want to add the more transparency is that a lot of money is being spent by public entities to buy insurance and reinsurance through this board. We buy a lot of, as a state, buy a lot of Ford vehicles. Are we going to be requiring Ford to have the same type of transparency on their board and open to public meeting laws, or 3M or any other company that we buy products through? Are we going to be try to and make them have to abide by the open meeting laws like this? Because my understanding, this is a private corporation that's a reinsurance for the insurance companies and the private insurers and the public insurers around the state. So I mean, I guess that's a question. Maybe it's a rhetorical question.
That kind of opened up a lot of potential ideas. You could see light bulbs going on over people's heads here. Do you want the author or one of our testifiers to speak to that, or was it?
I think it's more of a rhetorical question.
Thank you. Members, any other questions? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience that wants to come down and speak for or against this bill? Seeing no one come down, Representative Dalt will give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, I appreciate the comments and have had many conversations today about this this issue. And, you know, I know that there's some concern here. From my purview, I believe that this is just really a transparency issue. And you've got an organization that, you know, these organizations are required by law to use this entity for this service, and really would just like to know, in essence, how their monies are being invested once their premiums are paid. In the event that the investments are losing money, you know, this organization obviously can assess the membership back. And I know a few years ago we had a situation where the organization lost upwards of $500 million. So it's not small amounts of dollars that we're talking about here. And I believe that the membership was reassessed for that loss in the neighborhood of you know, a few $100 million. So these organizations really are just looking for some transparency and seeing and understanding how those investments are made and looking for a voice on that board of directors. So I certainly would appreciate your support, but I will also voice that I am very interested in working with any interested parties as this bill moves forward. We've got one more stop in committee and before we hit the floor. So certainly willing to keep those conversations open and make some adjustments if we can find some reasonable solutions to the problem. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would renew my motion that House File 2356, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Civil Law Data Practices Subcommittee.
Thank you, Representative Dalt. Representative Dalt renews his motion that House File 2356, as amended, be recommended to pass. Representative Dalt, do we need to send it to the Data Practices Subcommittee? Was that?
That's my understanding, okay. Mr. Chairman.
And we will send it there to the Data Practices Subcommittee of Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Dalt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lanning. Representative Lanning is coming before us to set a new land speed record on his bill. Representative Lanning, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 2178. And with that, Representative Lanning, welcome, and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. On behalf of the City of Moorhead, we are requesting that an additional liquor license be authorized to our city for the purpose of providing that service to the Blue Stem Center for the Arts. The Blue Stem Center is a very unique collaborative venture between the City of Moorhead and the Fargo School District and a private nonprofit organization. Back in 2003, we were successful in recruiting the Trollwood School for the Performing Arts being moved from Fargo to Moorhead. They were getting flooded out every year, and we provided a major state bonding support for this move. And subsequent to that, the school district in Fargo continued to provide support for the program, as well as being willing to take on some responsibility on the financial end. The private nonprofit has been raising money. They've raised substantial amount of money, about three times of what the state of Minnesota was able to provide. In order for them to serve the clientele that they have, this is a regional facility that attracts people from a wide area, and they have an outdoor amphitheater, one of the finest you'll find in the whole upper Midwest, and then they have an indoor facility for various events, and they would like to be able to have an additional liquor license to be able to serve various events for that center. So that's, in a nutshell, what this is about.
Thank you, Representative Lanning. Is there anyone in the audience that wants to speak for or against this bill? Members, any questions about this bill that we're going to lay over for possible inclusion in the omnibus liquor bill? Seeing none, Representative Lanning, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I forgot what number that is, but House File 2178 is laid over for, Representative Dietrich.
Yes, just a quick little note is that they should, Representative Lanning might want to have House Research change the bill summary. It says allows the city of Minneapolis to issue.
This could be a stadium vehicle bill. Good catch, Representative Dietrich.
At first, I was confused.
Thank you, Representative Dietrich. And Representative Lanning, will you check on that?
Yeah, I don't know where that came from. My summary says City of Moorhead, so.
Oh, you're kidding.
No.
It's a trick.
Yeah, I didn't see.
Oh, it's a trick. All right. Okay.
Just for
thank
the Democrats.
You.
All right.
Well, thank you, Representative Dietrich. Thank you, Representative Lanning. Members, I know we're a little bit over time, and I apologize for that, but Representative Loon, why don't you come up, and Mr. Stutroot, if you want to come down. And we want to hear this bill. We are not laying this one over. Is that correct, Representative Loon? We need to send this to the Tax Committee?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Representative Loon, please move your bill, and we'll go ahead and get started hearing it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 2280 be passed and sent to the Tax Committee. This is a bill which would adjust the definition for brewers that qualify for a tax credit that we provide for brewers that currently brew 100,000 barrels or fewer in a calendar year. It would increase that. And with that, I'm going to let the expert on this talk. I have Mark Stetrud here with me from Summit.
Thank you, Mr. Stetrud. Please Thank identify you. Yourself for the record and proceed when you're ready.
Mark Stetrud, president and founder of Summit Brewing Company, and it's S-T-U-T-R-U-D. Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for hearing this issue and even having the bill put together. Simply put, by the late 60s, the Minnesota legislature saw the necessity of providing a tax credit for smaller regional brewers due to the difficulty of the market and the dominance of bigger players. Since the late 60s, we have witnessed the demise of a number of regional brewers, not only in this state but across the country. And secondly, the industry has really gone to the point of where now we have two global entities that have about 80% market share. It's no surprise that small-scale brewing is incredibly expensive, and when it comes to excise taxes, 8% of our gross sales is a total of state and federal excise taxes. At the point that we lose this particular tax credit, that escalates to over 9.5% of our cost of gross sales. So this is certainly something that would support the growth of small breweries. And to change this definition of 100,000 barrels a year up to 250,000 barrels a year certainly is not a leap when it comes to industry standards. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stutroot. Members, any questions? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience that wants to come and testify for or against this bill? Seeing none? Really seeing none? Representative Loon, we'll give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to thank the members. Obviously, we're going to be hearing this in Tax Committee and do some work, but I think, again, this is important in terms of continuing to encourage our small brewers here, both Mr. Stetrud and some others, brewers. I know Mr. Marty, I think, was hoping to be here from Shell's, but they both are hoping to add employees and expand their businesses. It's a very capital-intensive business, and this just helps them be able to do that.
Well, thank you, Representative Loon and Mr. Stutrud, and I agree. I think these are important businesses. We want more jobs, and it's awfully nice to have more brewing jobs. So thank
Very
you.
Very true. Thank you.
And with that, Representative Loon renews her motion that House File 2280 be passed and sent to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Loon. Thank you, members. Members, thank you for your patience today. We ran a little long. We didn't get to every bill on the agenda. Sorry. We are going to do one more bill. Representative Grunhagen, come on up. House File 1416. Sorry, Representative Grunhagen. I thought that you had already left and we were doing yours tomorrow.
Okay. No, I'm used to being skipped over in my life, let me tell you.
Aww.
Thanks for the groan.
Representative O'Driscoll, would you like to move this bill for Representative Grunhagen?
Mr. Chair, I move 1416, and it will go to...
Representative Grunhagen, as far as I know, General Register.
Yeah, that's
okay. The General Register.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Representative Grunhagen, welcome to the committee. Please tell us why you're here, what the bill is about. And as always in commerce, we appreciate brevity, especially when we're already 6 minutes past our assigned
time.
This will be
great. I do have an amendment, Mr. Chair.
Oh, boy.
It's just a small technical amendment, A2.
Got it. Do you want to explain what the small technical amendment does?
It simply adds some clarification to the language on line 1.1. It adds the word leave after the, or it adds the word from after the word leave, and it inserts the statement after the word reinstatement in the person's civilian position of employment within Minnesota.
Members, any questions to the amendment? Not seeing any. Let's go ahead and vote on the A2 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Grunhagen to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Real briefly, this bill would ensure that a Minnesotan who is a member of another state's National Guard and he lives in Minnesota, such as serving in the North Dakota National Guard, would have the same reemployment rights following activation for a state emergency, such as a flood or natural disaster. As a Minnesotan serving with the Minnesota National Guard would have if activated by, for a Minnesota emergency. Basically, this was brought to me by a constituent in my district. He's a member of the National Guard up in North Dakota. Right now, if he's called up for an emergency to North Dakota, he does not have any reemployment rights. A Minnesota National Guard person would have the reemployment rights if they were called up for an emergency. So this simply extends the benefit to any Minnesotan who is a member of a National Guard outside of the state of Minnesota.
Sounds good, Representative Grunhagen. Is there anyone in the audience that wants to testify for or against this bill? Members, any questions to this bill? Seeing none, Representative O'Driscoll renews his motion that House File 1416, as amended, be passed and referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Thank you,
Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Members, thank you for your patience today. I hate to, I don't like it when the committee runs past time, so my apologies. And one last thing, we are going to meet here at 6 o'clock tomorrow night, our regular committee time. We are not meeting out of respect for Senator Kubley. So hopefully we'll see everybody tomorrow night. With that, we are adjourned.